Hey listeners, this is Seth, Faye's sound engineer. You may have heard in a recent episode that Faye is going to be in the process soon of producing a new podcast. She's really excited about it and hopes you are too, but unfortunately that means episodes of Follow the Science are going to be getting a little less regular. She still intends to release episodes when she can, so stay tuned, but she needs to divert some resources to this new endeavor. So keep an ear out for updates on that new podcast. Thanks for understanding, and happy listening.
For a lot of us, the biggest fears associated with COVID have little to do with hospitals, ventilators, or death, and a lot more to do with fear of either giving the disease to somebody who's high risk or getting long COVID. Some people who got COVID as early as March or April of 2020 are still suffering from problems. Some of them have crushing fatigue and a scary-sounding cognitive problem that's been dubbed brain fog. But how common is long COVID, and what are its main symptoms, and who's likely to get better and who isn't? So, as promised, this is the second of several episodes on long COVID that I've made for Follow the Science. I'm your host, Faye Flam. I'm a science journalist and a Bloomberg opinion columnist, and this podcast grew out of a grant from the Society for Professional Journalists. My guest today is a doctor who's leading one of the country's major centers for studying and treating people with long COVID. His name is Bruce Levy, and he's at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. And he had been the chief of pulmonary critical care there, but lately he's been devoting most of his efforts to treating patients with long COVID and to trying to understand what's going on with this condition, what factors might be causing it, and what kinds of treatments doctors might be able to use to help these patients. Maybe let's start by talking about your center there at Brigham. So do you have a center that is devoted to both research and treating patients with long COVID?
Yes, we have a COVID recovery center. It's a multidisciplinary center that is now about 15 months old, something along those lines, that we started because of the growing number of patients experiencing long COVID. It's multidisciplinary. There's providers from multiple different specialties that combined to take care of patients' individual needs because long COVID affects so many different aspects of people's lives.
Well, it leads to something I was wondering about, that people sort of see long COVID as this very surprising thing, but it sounds like there are other infectious diseases that can lead to long-term symptoms or syndromes after the disease is cleared.
There are. There's a couple to mark on. One of them that's common is influenza, and influenza can affect for a while, many weeks to even months, people's ability to fight off routine bacterial infections. So there are many patients after a serious infection with influenza who could have a subsequent bacterial infection, a bacterial pneumonia afterwards. So there's been a susceptibility created by the initial viral infection that has long-term consequences. Another common example, perhaps, is mononucleosis. The Epstein-Barr virus that causes mono can really create very long-lived fatigue in people. And interestingly, one of the risk factors, it seems, for the development of long COVID is when initially diagnosed with COVID, concomitant presence of Epstein-Barr virus, that monovirus. So,
don't most of us have EBV, even if we don't remember having mono? I thought that there were some surveys that showed that it's extremely common, almost ubiquitous.
Correct. That's correct. So this is almost like a reactivation, a reawakening of the Epstein-Barr virus. Why that happens in some people is definitely not known yet in these long COVID patients. But potentially, that is something that could be detected, and potentially we could come up with therapeutic approaches that would hopefully mitigate the risk for developing long COVID. But that's an area of active research right now.
My next question is about chronic fatigue syndrome, which is officially known as ME-CFS, and which experts say is triggered by viral infections, though it's not very well understood. And is ME-CFS known to be connected to Epstein-Barr, or is it sort of mysterious that we don't know which viruses trigger that?
It is thought to be triggered by viruses, but it not only one virus. It is still somewhat mysterious, I would say. But it is a post-viral syndrome.
It is pretty, that's pretty well understood that it, people who have it report having some sort of viral illness before
it's very
they
common.
Develop this.
It's very common, although not only viruses. Some people may have had other infections, Lyme disease, for example.
Another interesting long-term
condition. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. I mean, one of the things I wrote about the previous time I wrote about long COVID was that maybe some of the research would shed light on some of these other, you know, was at least getting people to think about these things more and realize they're not all psychosomatic, that Lyme disease is real and ME/CFS is real.
That's correct. You know, the recent study in Nature showing the brain scans shows pretty convincing evidence that there's been changes with the acute infection in COVID. And so this is, you know, I guess in some ways it is in people's head, but not because I'm malingering. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. In fact, before we go on to my other questions on my list, I'd love to get your take on what that study tells us and how to interpret it. This is the same study I've talked about in at least two previous episodes, and that's because it's a study that a lot of people have been talking about. It's a study that used brain imaging to conclude that there were tiny changes apparent in the brains of people who'd had COVID, what the researchers described as atrophy in regions associated with smell and memory.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It definitely will need some replication and further study. But in a routine series of investigations, getting brain scans in over 400 people before and after developing COVID, there was evidence of abnormalities after the infection in specific areas of the brain that seemed somewhat reproducible and related to the olfactory pathways, the limbic system and the olfactory pathways. And so the abnormalities that people experience with smell and taste may suggest that those pathways were also deeper in the brain affected. I think it's quite interesting. It's a kind of scientific evidence for abnormalities after infection that could be leading to people experiencing brain fog or other complaints with memory or stringing thoughts together. It's not clear how permanent this is or how reversible it will be. And it's also not clear how uniform this is in our patients with long COVID. But quite interesting and really provides an interesting window into how the virus may be affecting, at least temporarily, people's cognition.
And one of the things that was sort of hard for lay people like me to tell from a study like this is whether the statistical significance came from the fact that there were a few of the patients had a big change or a lot of the patients had a small change. Now, were you able to discern that?
Yeah, I it's hard for me to comment on that because I'm not sure that that's discernible so far from the.
Yeah, it seems like that would lead to a different interpretation if it was that, you know, 10 of the patients had something really dramatic happen and many others who had COVID had nothing happen to their brains, that could lead to the same overall statistically significant result.
Yes, and that's a question, I think, for the investigators, but again, even if it's, you know, a few people with more significant changes, I do think that's a potential window into the pathobiology of what may be happening. And, you know, even small changes on the MRI could have significant functional changes for individuals depending on their location in the brain. So the statistical significance is one thing, but the potential functional significance is another. So some of these can be challenging to detect. So the fact that there were definable abnormalities is, I think, quite interesting.
Yeah. And so I also wondered about the changes in sense of smell. That's something that anecdotally I've heard from friends who don't even consider themselves having had long COVID. They just say, yeah, it's weird. You know, I had COVID and nothing really smells the same anymore. And so it seems like that, is that a pretty common long-term symptom that you're seeing?
So I would say of the people that are coming to see us in our COVID recovery center, maybe about 10% of them have some persistent changes in their sense of smell, And they are evaluated by experts in ear, nose, and throat for this. This is an area that we'll be actively researching as part of the RECOVER initiative. Everybody who comes in after their baseline visit will have an opportunity to have smell testing done in a structured way. In terms of the acute infection, it was quite common with acute COVID, especially in the earliest variants, the Alpha variant and the Delta variant. Maybe a little less common with Omicron, but still present. And so I definitely think it was part of the characterization of the initial infection. Anecdotally, from our recruiting in the RECOVER initiative, we are finding that people who consider themselves uninfected, so they're enrolling as a control, there's some people out there that when we do the antibody testing to truly test to see if they were uninfected, they're turning positive. So they may not have realized it, but they actually did have COVID. So especially with Omicron, that was quite common.
Yeah, I would love to know whether I've had it. I mean, if that many cases were asymptomatic, I don't get tested regularly for any reason. So it would be interesting to know.
There are some specific antibodies that can be checked in your system. There are some specific tests that would not be influenced by the vaccine. So that could be done. It's more at the level of research. It's not done routinely clinically, of course.
Yeah. So I'm still also trying to understand whether there are different categories of long COVID and if there's a way to get sort of rough numbers on how common it is. When I first reported on it, it sounded like there were some fairly different things lumped together, including people that were just still in bad shape because they'd been on a ventilator, had been really sick. And then the sort of more mysterious cases of people that had a really mild infection, but then had problems that went on for weeks or months.
Yes, you're right to ask. Let's take one step back. So the formal definition of post-acute sequelae of COVID infection, PASC or PASC for short,
right? Yes.
Is an umbrella term to encompass long COVID. So you develop symptoms with acute infection and 30 days or longer, you still have some of those symptoms. They have not completely gone away. The duration of symptoms is much longer than we would have expected for an acute infection that should have resolved within the first week to couple weeks and certainly within the first month. That's given the term long COVID in the US, long hauler COVID in the UK. And then there are these post-acute experiences that are challenging to define, that people seemingly had a relatively mild infection. The infection went away, and then a few weeks or months later, new symptoms emerged that seem somehow referable back to the initial infection. And all of that is under this umbrella of PASC.
Here's where he starts to talk about what might be causing those more mysterious cases of long COVID that follow relatively mild cases of the disease.
One of them appears to be related to kind of chronic inflammation of uncertain cause and defective kind of engagement of the inflammation breaking signals. These pro-resolving signals and pathways haven't kicked in the way you'd expect. That's another group of patients, almost certainly. And then lastly, there are these people that may have some persistence of virus or viral fragments in the way that the herpes viruses can persist. And maybe that's driving some chronic symptomatology in patients. So there's a bunch of different theories and likely underlying mechanisms for the symptoms that people are experiencing with long COVID. But this is an area of active research, and it's still relatively in the realm of theory. There's emerging data, but it's quite interesting. And there's probably other theories as well.
So instead of thinking of this as something where people are still debating the mechanism, there may be multiple mechanisms that different patients may be experiencing different things, that the virus could hide out the way other viruses sometimes do, or it could be that the immune system can't shut itself off properly.
Correct. Yeah, that's very likely that there's not one unifying mechanism. It's possible, but it's very likely that there's not one. And I would view this as a syndrome. So for example, you could have back pain, and that could be from a bunch of different reasons why you have back pain. You could have long COVID, and there's a bunch of different reasons that may underlie that. And as we understand those reasons in more detail, we can then develop understandings of risk factors and markers, clinical indicators of which of the mechanisms are at play, and ultimately kind of clinical therapeutics and clinical trials could be done to directly address those kind of underlying mechanisms.
Is there any way to put a number on how common long COVID is, and maybe even break it down to say how common it is for mild infections to lead to long COVID?
Yeah, this is an area that's part of our active research agenda in RECOVER. It is very hard to put a number on it. There have been high estimates in the 30 to 40% range of folks, and there has been lower estimates more in the single digits, say 5%, something like that. But I think it's very clear that there's an enormous number of people that are experiencing long COVID because, for example, I mean, nationally in the United States, we've had nearly 80 million cases of acute COVID. If even 1% of folks had that, we're talking about millions of people, hundreds of thousands of people that are experiencing this. And so the number of patients suffering with this is very large. And whether it's, you know, a multiple of 1%, you know, it doesn't take much to get to a very big number. And we're seeing this clinically, and everybody across the nation and at the provider level is seeing patients coming in with these syndromes. So it's something that we desperately need answers for.
What are the most common symptoms that really drag on for a long time? The ones that are, you know, more than a 30 days or 60 or 90 days?
I would say the exertional symptoms, especially fatigue, and shortness of breath is quite common. The mental health issues are quite common, brain fog as well. And then some of the rheumatologic, the autoimmune type syndromes where people have muscle aches, joint aches, that kind of thing. There are a cluster of syndromes that can last a long time. Some people have had problems, and this is fewer in number, but with their heart or with their gastrointestinal tract, and those can be quite persistent as well.
Can you describe brain fog, what people are describing that gets classified that way?
Yes, it's really, again, a kind of a syndrome, and it means different things to different people, but it's generally associated with some changes in memory, some ability to think crisply and clearly and quickly, some problems with stringing thoughts together. And some mood disorders can be associated with that as well. Sleep disturbances can accumulate there as well. It's a group of symptoms that, and some people have just one or a couple of those. Not everybody has all of those.
Is there any indication of which types of patients are likely to get better when you see certain patients? Are you seeing patterns where a certain type of patient or type of symptom, you think, okay, this one is probably going to get better. And when you see a different type of patient, you think, uh-oh, this one, people like this don't tend to get better.
There's, again, active research going on in this, and hopefully we will learn more there. As a population of people suffering with long COVID, there has been a little bit of natural history that's emerged over up to about 9 months or a year. And it does seem like of the folks who have long COVID, about a third of them get better in the first 3 to 6 months. And then another third or maybe even 40% of them get better over the course of the next 3 to 6 months. But there seems to be about a 10% or 15% of people that, you know, now we're about 2 years, you know, into this, have persistent issues. So there are people that have, unfortunately, have some persistent issues here, and who those are and learning how the others are getting better will hopefully provide some windows into therapeutic approaches to help these folks.
Yeah, I think that's what really scares people out there is long COVID is one thing, and having a permanent, permanent symptoms is something completely different. So do you see that about 10% of patients haven't been able to get better?
Yes, that's what some of the reports that I was mentioning are seeing. And, you know, in our experience now here in Boston, because we did have such an early surge in 2020, we definitely have some people that we're seeing that were infected then and persistent symptoms. So we definitely need answers for those patients.
And for those people, what are the symptoms that they're still experiencing for the ones that are more than a year out?
They're the symptoms we've talked about in terms of long COVID, but there's not one definable pattern, in other words. Fatigue remains an issue. You know, often some of these symptoms have lessened some. They're not quite as severe as they were when they originally contracted them, but they persist.
Are there any hints as to treatments or things people have been able to do that have improved their symptoms?
So in terms of medicinal therapies, right now I would say we don't have a one-size-fits-all medicinal treatment. In terms of vaccination, there does seem to be a severity gradient. So more severe initial infections, more likely to develop long COVID, less severe initial infections, less likely. And we know that, while we know that the vaccines don't prevent infection, they are very good at decreasing the severity of the initial infection. And so vaccination is almost certainly kind of helpful in this regard in terms of preventing the development of long COVID. Once one has long COVID, it's very unclear whether vaccination will help. In terms of non-medicinal therapies, rehabilitation is something that's been quite helpful for many people. And so we're leveraging those strategies with rehabilitation experts. And then paying close attention to general kind of health and hygiene has been helpful for some people as it relates to, you know, the eating habits and what they're eating and sleeping habits, and being quite rigorous about this. And then the last thing I would say is for those people with physical limitations or problems with brain fog, kind of not pushing too hard, not kind of pushing through it, you know, respecting where their body's at and being active cognitively and physically, but on a regular basis, but not overdoing it. It does seem like some people have gotten the advice to just push through it, and actually that can backtrack, it can backfire on people. So it takes time. That's the bottom line. Some of these things will get better.
Yeah, I've heard that with chronic fatigue too, that people sometimes get set back. So it's sort of the opposite of what, when you're healthy, happens, that you work out harder and it makes you stronger. But
it's the opposite of that. That's right.
Do you think that the existence of long COVID and the risk of it should influence policy about restrictions and non-pharmaceutical measures?
Explain what you mean. Sorry, I don't think I fully understand.
People sort of are, you know, lifting different kinds of mandates based on acute infections, hospitalizations, death rates, but haven't really taken long COVID into consideration. And I wondered if that's that should be a consideration in addition to the factors that are, you know, standard for deciding when to impose mandates or lift them?
Yeah, it's still premature, I would say. We don't really know the true incidence of long COVID, and we don't know enough about the risk factors and the segments of the population that would be at risk for long COVID. As part of the RECOVER initiative, we're recruiting a broad range of demographics in our population for study, so all ages, really across the entire lifespan, pediatrics, adults, pregnant women, their neonates. And we'll start to get some answers that could potentially inform public policy and public mandates. But right now, I think I wouldn't factor long COVID into those discussions because we just don't know enough.
Do you think it should factor into people's individual risk calculations, that people are sort of making decisions now about whether to go to restaurants, whether to hang out with their friends, for young people, whether to go to clubs and parties and things? Should the risk of long COVID factor into that, or is it too soon to know?
I think that's at the individual level, I would want to learn more about long COVID and its risk. And that's, of course, what we're doing with this research study. So at some level, it's an unknown, and how people kind of factor that individually into their kind of social behaviors is, of course, very reasonable for people to think about this. Long COVID is no fun, I'll tell you that. Definitely wouldn't want it. Most people that have it are quite jarred by the experience about how they haven't returned to their baseline health. And that could be a marathoner who just can't run quite as fast as they did and otherwise seems quite functional. And it could be somebody who's actually having trouble walking across their apartment because they get so short of breath. So I think how an individual factors that risk into their calculus is, of course, it's quite reasonable. It's just we don't know enough to really, in an informed way, factor this into public health policy.
I've wondered whether funneling more money into long COVID research will take money away from other areas of medical research that are important, or whether you think that it may pay off because there's so much to learn here that it'll pay off for other areas too, because so much is tied to chronic inflammation or autoimmune problems, whether we'll learn so much about the human body and disease from long COVID research that it'll pay dividends in other areas.
Yes, I'd like not to think of it as a trade-off of one for the other. There's definitely an urgent need to learn more about long COVID for the hundreds of thousands or millions of people that are experiencing it. I would also say that there is much to learn from long COVID that may translate to other conditions people are experiencing. We know that some comorbidities, some chronic illnesses predispose to long COVID, such as type 2 diabetes. And a question would be why? What's going on there? And maybe that will help people with diabetes, you know, down the road as well, as one example. But we definitely need more funding. I would also say this is a good opportunity to think about kind of leveraging the public health infrastructures that have been put in place related to the pandemic and the vaccination efforts and figure out ways to invest in our public health. I think it would be remiss not to just focus for a moment on our most vulnerable communities who are hit so hard by acute COVID and are now experiencing a tremendous burden from long COVID, our Black and Brown communities. There's an important health equity mission here that it would be wonderful if our government officials and policy experts could help support the public infrastructure that's been built up, public health funding. Is obviously a challenge.
That makes sense because if people can avoid getting COVID, they will not get long COVID. And it seems like we haven't done a very good job so far in helping people avoid getting COVID. I mean, it's been pretty challenging because it keeps mutating into forms that are harder and harder to avoid.
Yes, the transmission of the more recent variants has been even more challenging. Although the severity has been at least somewhat less, especially in vaccinated people.
Yeah, and I guess time will tell whether the Omicron variant leads to long COVID as often as the earlier ones.
Yes, we're still learning.
Since it hasn't been around very long.
Yeah, we're still learning about that. That's right.
Yeah, so I'll let you go. But I wondered if there are any other papers or research areas, you know, that I might want to look at. Everybody's focused on this recent Nature paper, but is there anything that I might want to look at? Other research papers that have come out of other groups that you found particularly enlightening?
I think there's a very nice report in Cell that came out within the last month from a group in the Pacific Northwest. I think Sue, S-U is the first author, it's the last name. And they looked at over 300 people that they did a multi-omic study, multiple different types of kind of unbiased analyses, and link that in this over 300 patients to their patient-reported outcomes and clinical findings. And they did it specifically to look for, at the time of initial diagnosis, what might predict the trajectory of recovery over 2 to 3 months. And they found some significant insight into risk factors for the development of long COVID. It's a very well-done study. And that's one of the studies that has shown that type 2 diabetes is a risk factor. There were some specific autoantibodies for the development of autoimmunity that were a risk factor for developing long COVID. And the presence of Epstein-Barr virus at the time of initial diagnosis. The intensity of infection was also found to be a risk factor with levels of RNA of the virus in the circulation at the time of initial diagnosis. So that's a really well done study you might want to take a look at.
I did look it up, and it's a really interesting paper, maybe something I'll try to translate into plain English for a future Bloomberg column and future episode of my podcast. You can find it pretty easily if you Google Sue, S-U, and Cell, and Long COVID. So it looks like a lot of people are working really hard to understand the problem of long COVID, and I hope for a lot of people's sake that they keep getting funding. And I think the researchers are right that what they learned from studying long COVID might shed some light on other so-called post-viral syndromes, such as chronic fatigue syndrome and long Lyme disease, which is something that a lot of people have been suffering as well.
You've been listening to Follow the Science. Follow the Science is produced by Faye Flam. You can follow Faye on Twitter at Faye Flam. That's at FAYEFLAM. If you like this episode, consider subscribing. And if you really like this episode, leave a positive review wherever you heard it. Thanks in advance, and thank you for listening.